This is Junk Food Cinema.
We're gonna get you, bloodsuckers. Well, that is, we're gonna get you another episode of Junk Food Cinema.
What?
Right here on the Blog Talk Radio Network. How's everybody doing? All you shit suckers and happy monsters out there.
You know they can't answer, right? This is
a podcast.
Can't?
Oh, it's like...
It's not even like live radio where they can call in and be like, we're doing great!
You're right. This is like the radio equivalent of not having a reflection. I'm talking to no one and expecting an answer. But we are the weekly cult and exploitation film cast dedicated to a higher purpose.
We are the frog brothers of the internet.
We are fighters for truth, justice, and the American slam at Denny's. You better believe it. I am Brian Salisbury. I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host, novelist, screenwriter, the third frog brother, lieutenant of Megaforce, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
Going all right. Just got back from Hawaii.
Of course.
Literally just got back from Hawaii. I got home, and like 2 hours later, you were here, and we're recording.
There's no layover for junk food. It just keeps happening. Hey guys, if you like the show, follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. You can get our entire back catalog on the Blog Talk Radio Network. And I want to let you know of a couple of upcoming live appearances for Junk Food Cinema. The first being this very weekend, Saturday, 8 p.m. for ArmadilloCon. That's going to take place at the Omni South Park. We're going to be creeping up Ballroom D, talking John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, the meat of his apocalypse sandwich,
yes,
you might say.
Indeed.
So that'll be a lot of fun. And then tickets are selling fast for our Summer Junk Food Marathon at the Omaha Alamo Draft House Saturday, August 12th, starting at 4 p.m. We got three great movies on deck. They just had to call an audible, and Speed has been replaced by True Lies, which, no disrespect to Speed whatsoever, I think that's a trade-up. So I'm super excited. We're gonna see.
You didn't even tell me this yet. Like, I'm literally finding out about this now. That
breaking
we're not
news.
Doing Speed.
It's not. It was a decision by the studio, apparently, that they just didn't want it shown. So we had to call an audible, and True Lies was selected as the fill-in, which of course means that Bill Paxton is now in the mix for that marathon.
See, I was about to say, like, we often talk about how he is one of the first faces we decided absolutely goes on Mount Junk Food.
Yep.
And that makes me really happy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be a lot of fun to discuss. And we got those three movies. We got a live show from us truly, special junk food menu items, and an exclusive t-shirt. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
We better fucking have true fries.
Mm.
If we don't have true fries, I'm calling. I'm not going. We better have true fries.
I'm sorry to the management of the Alamo Omaha. One of our demands we've added to the list, in addition to beer enema and all green M&Ms, is now true fries.
True fries.
Which is just fries with the McDonald's special sauce all over them. I don't care how you have to do it. Just make it happen. Go to drafthouse.com/Omaha for tickets. It's looking like we're going to have more tour stops next year, which is really exciting. So keep your ears peeled for those details. And if you really like the show, please consider becoming a patron. You can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and pledge some dough. For as little as $4 a month, you'll get access to our bonus content, the Extra Helpings, as we like to call them. Mailbags, a la mode, Summer of 77, Top 5, so much stuff. If you're wondering what that might sound like, chew on this free sample of moments from the bonus shows compiled by our friend Meryl Barr. Oh, hey, the mailbag's here.
Mailbag, you know our love of Swayze.
All of the Walgreens and CVS are desperate to get rid of their Valentine's Day candy.
I am Logan. Right now, I don't need the mic stand anymore. I'm plugging the mic to my...
Do any of these sound like a good idea?
And a painting of Godzilla.
Oh, f*** me.
And a painting of Mothra.
F*** me.
And a painting of Rodan.
Shut the f*** up. I don't understand peeps. I never have.
This is behind the Murphy mask.
This is our McRib.
This is our McRib.
He becomes Spacen. Computer.
Solid pun work, bro.
Wait, is that when it happens, like your career gets resurrected while you're getting f*** up on the toilet?
No, that's a Plumpkin.
Anyway, hold on.
Say goodbye to my hate witch.
Yeah, so that is just
That was a whole lot of us in rapid fire.
That was. It was almost too much to handle. The music there by Reigning Monarchs, so definitely check them out. And like I said, patreon.com. Housekeeping over. The summer of 87 would not be complete without a trip to Santa Carla for one of the best vampire movies of the decade.
One of the best. Not the, yes. Because we are
hence
in,
my exact phrasing, one of the best yes. vampire movies of the decade.
We are still of the opinion here at Junk Food Cinema that the greatest vampire film of the decade, and perhaps the greatest modern vampire film, is Near Dark.
Which is, it's ironic that this is one of the best vampire movies of the decade, and it's not even the best vampire movie of the year it was released.
Yeah.
That's how many great vampire movies came out in the 1980s. But I am, of course, setting up a singing our insert obvious joke here into The Lost Boys.
Michael and Sam have just moved to Santa Carla, California. They're about to discover its secret.
Notice anything unusual about Santa Carla yet?
No. It's a pretty cool place. If you're a Martian...
Or a vampire.
So where are you? The flying nun!
I'm your brother, Sammy. Help me!
Stay back! Stay back!
What's happening to me, Star?
Get yourself a good sharp stick. Drive it right through his heart.
You're a vampire, Michael.
My own brother, a damn blood-sucking vampire.
Oh, you wait till Mom finds out, buddy.
Before we go any further, Cargo, before we dive into this movie and everything we love about it and everything that makes it great, everything that makes it hold up to this day, I have a very important question for you.
Which is?
Is Peter Pan a vampire?
No, but it is a really great metaphor for vampires.
Well, think about it. Peter Pan never grows up. He never grows old. All he wants to do is fight people at night, and during the day, he's mostly just sleeping. And he flies. I mean, come on. Like, he's got to be some kind of supernatural being, right?
Oh, well, absolutely. But I don't think that it has anything to do with vampirism.
He steals children from their beds, which, according to this movie, is also what these vampires are doing, if all of the missing signs are to be believed.
I agree, which is why it makes such a great metaphor that's used in this movie. And they don't even... Like, here's the brilliance of this movie. Like, shortly, I think... 14 years after this movie was made, you have Spielberg's AI.
Mm-hmm.
And they use the Blue Fairy as a very big metaphor in the movie about, you know, chasing down the Blue Fairy, about, you know, the boy that wouldn't grow up. And then Spielberg gets literal with it. Here, the only reference to what's going on is the title. Like, they do not make Peter Pan jokes. They do not lay it on real thick. But with that title, you end up watching this movie through a modern lens and seeing the parallels with Peter Pan. And it is exceptionally brilliant just how that's done and how this is a Peter Pan tale.
Mm-hmm.
And how... this boy is being seduced into vampirism, and you know how these kids are taken and turned into a family. And ultimately, thematically, by the end, you see that what the master vampire really wants is just a vampiric family. He wants an actual family, which is interesting.
Which, like, makes one or both of the Corys Captain Hook.
It would easily be Feldman.
I guess you're right about that.
There's Corey sub one and Corey sub two.
This is the Corey combo. This movie, the first.
Yes, this is what
Corey combo number one.
This is what brought us the Coreys, which we actually have covered one of the Coreys movies.
Yes,
ages ago. For those of you interested in hearing, we covered the quite good Dream a Little Dream, which is easily the best of the Corey movies that are actually Corey movies. This is not one of the Corey movies.
No, it's a movie that features the Corey combo, which, by the way, I just realized saying that again, if Junk Food Cinema had its own storefront fast food chain, the number one item on the menu would be the Corey combo. You would be able to order a number one, which would just be the Corey combo. But no, this, if you really want to get technical with it, we've actually covered this movie before, but we covered it in one of our very first episodes, which was sort of a capsule review of all of our favorite vampire movies of the 80s. So we really went a mile wide and an inch deep. Okay. I just left it out there just in case, but you sidestepped the easy joke, Cargill, and I'm proud of you on that.
I did, because...
I think it's the jet lag, really. I mean... That's probably causing you to just leave those on the vine.
Look, I don't know if your fiance listens to this or not, and she just had a baby, and the jokes are way too obvious, and, you know.
It is called junk food cinema, so even the low-hanging fruit is too healthy for us to
touch.
That
is true.
But yeah.
Yeah, fruit is way too healthy.
Yeah, fuck fruit. Here, let me take another sip of this coffee real quick, which is loaded with more sugar than fucking Willy Wonka's veins. Anyway, yeah, we did technically cover this movie, but we just kind of brushed upon it. So now we really want to go in depth. As it is, you know, the longer we've done this series, and I'm sure when we got to this point last year, I had the same thought. It is fucking staggering how many great movies came out in the summer of 87.
And we're playing at the same time in a theater that these were what you got to choose from. And not every year is like that, you know. This is why I felt that this year we definitely had to do 87, because there are, like, there's a lot of forgotten gems in there where, you know, we pointed out things like Project X where people are like, holy shit, I forgot that movie existed. But there really were a lot of, like, big, huge movies that we still talk about, that we still watch, that when they come out on Blu-ray, all of, you know, film Twitter gets a flutter, you know. And this is one of those summers, and Lost Boys is one of the biggest. Interestingly enough, Lost Boys was already referenced this summer because it was on the marquee of
Lethal Weapon.
Of Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, in a scene where Murtaugh and Riggs are walking by a movie theater, because Lethal Weapon was, of course, directed by Richard Donner, who is the executive producer on this movie and very nearly directed it.
And this movie had not come out yet when they shot that scene. They were, if you remember, it said this summer's big hit. The Lost Boys, like they were like bending over and sucking their own dick.
Which I heard you can get fired for being able to do.
Steve Bannon style. Yeah. In the film. So it was,
for those of you listening in 2028, you have no idea what the fuck we're talking about.
I don't think anyone is going to, I don't know the world's going to be here in 2028.
That's true.
If it's not a post-apocalyptic wasteland, we have failed.
Because of said individuals that we have referenced, there may be no 2028. But while there is a 2017 and while there was a 1987, let's talk a little bit before we dive into the plot here. Of some of the, we were talking already about the connections between Lost Boys and some of these other movies. I want to talk about the connection between this movie and Near Dark. As we said, two of our favorite vampire movies of the 80s. I think I'm with you. I think I went back and listened to that episode again, and I think on that episode I said that Lost Boys is my favorite of the 80s vampire movies, but I kind of think I was wrong. I think it's definitely Near Dark, but this is a very close second. I adore this movie.
Well, as time goes on, these movies age very differently. And Near Dark is a film that gets better with age. It is a fine wine.
Sure.
Like every time I watch Near Dark, it is just a deeper, darker, bolder film. Somebody did a really great 6-minute breakdown of the barroom scene, a commentary for it, and they were just kind of going through, you know, what the cinematographer's background was and how he shot it and just the way it's paced. And it's just so elegantly, brilliantly put together. Like, you, when watching that movie, you can see why Catherine Bigelow is going to be such a tour de force on the scene as a director for 30 fucking years. Mm-hmm. And here, this is a film done by Joel Schumacher, somebody who is extraordinarily hit or miss.
Yeah.
But when he hits, he makes something cool and memorable and unlike anything else anyone has ever seen. When he misses, he makes something trashy and terrible and unlike anything anyone has ever seen.
Oh, yeah. Put a pin in that Batman for a second, because, yeah, the weird thing, though, about The Lost Boys and Near Dark coming out in the same year is how similar they are. These are both movies about a young teen who falls in love with a girl, and that relationship ends up getting him, runs him afoul of a clan of vampires. He gets bit, he gets turned, and then spends the rest of the movie fighting the urges until somebody can cure him of that vampirism.
Which happens to be members of his own family.
Yes.
And both vampire clans claim a young boy as a member. Both are extraordinarily violent, nihilistic.
Yeah. And here's where it gets real extreme predator on us again. There are Jason Patrick in this movie And Joshua John Miller, who plays the young kid vampire who is also in Teen Witch in Near Dark, are half brothers. So there is a bloodline relationship between those two movies as well. So it's real eerie that those two movies came out in the same year and how similar that they are.
Yeah. Yeah, they really, it's very much parallel thinking. And yet, at the same time, tonally, they could not be more different.
Correct.
Like, Near Dark is not a fun movie.
No.
It's not fun. It's not, hey, dude, let's throw on Near Dark and throw back a couple of beers. This is fucking fun. Because when this movie goes off, the few moments that this movie goes off the rails into Shitsville, it's amazing. Like one of the greatest terrible moments of this film is Sexy Sax Guy.
I am glad that let me just do a quick time check here. We didn't even get 15 minutes into this episode before we landed on the heart of this movie, which is, of course, Sexy Shirtless Sax Guy.
It's got at the 10 pounds of baby oil on that guy alone.
He's like, if a David Lynch character tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs and was banned from Twin Peaks and just shows up in this town and it's like, we don't know what it is you are or what you're doing, but we're celebrating it.
Here's the thing about Schumacher. Schumacher is one of those guys who's always hip to the trends. It has been, for almost the entirety of his career, one of the hippest fucking directors in Hollywood. When he was a screenwriter in the early 70s, he penned two screenplays which were hip as fuck and still talked about in film circles today. The Wiz and Car Wash. And from that, he built a film career. And that film career was always on the cutting edge of what was going on in cinema. But the problem with being on the cutting edge, as I've discussed in the past, is that sometimes you are foreseeing the future of cinema. You are going off into some new territory and paving the way. And sometimes you are cutting through the jungle and then falling off a cliff. And this is a great example of that in terms of everything in this film that's trying to be cool is of the 80s, but it's all the stuff that was momentary in the 80s. Like, you and I made a drinking game while watching this out of Corey Haim's shirt choices.
Every time Corey Haim appears in a scene wearing a new terrible shirt, you take a drink.
And that will get you fucked up.
And by act two, you are verschnockered.
I mean, he's like, he goes through 2-3 shirts a day in some, on some days.
Yeah, there were scenes where it was clearly the same day, and it's like, dude, I am running out of shot glasses. What is going on here?
Like, there's only 2 or 3 shirts he wears in this movie where you're like, all right, you know what? That's something that you'd think walking down the street, you'd be like, oh, dude, that's a cool shirt.
That looks like clothing.
Everything else is like, wow, dude, you were trying too hard. Like, they make, like, the Frog Brothers make fun of his clothing about being a fashion victim.
While one of them is wearing a flight suit, and you're still on their side about it.
You're still on their side. Like, this, that part didn't age, and then everybody flipping out to Sexy Sax Guy.
Back to Sexy Sax Guy.
Well, we have not finished talking about Sexy Sax Guy yet. Because Sexy Sax Guy is standing between two trash cans full of fire, meaning there are 3 flaming, burning trash cans on stage at that moment.
It is just,
there's no time in the 80s where you'd be like, I'm going to go see a guy sing and play saxophone while he's greased up in that much baby oil and wearing, like, spandex pants
and chains.
Yeah. Now, see, the thing is that when you go and you look at the Vampire Clan, you know, you look at which, by the way, has 2 phenomenal actors in it.
Hell yeah.
They actually look very of the age. Like, they look like a fucking metal band. Yeah. Like, and not like a metal band, like
Rat.
They're a perfect example. They're just this shade of cooler than Winger.
Hair metal band.
Yes. That is, yes. I mean, they're just this side of Winger, but not quite Guns N' Roses.
Junk Food Cinema, just this side of Winger, not quite Guns N' Roses. New t-shirt, folks.
But that's the thing. If you go back and you look, you know, I mean, they don't go all the way to the end and become the Nelson, but they're still, you know...
I can't live without these outdated references.
I love that you went right to Nelson.
Of course I went to Nelson.
After the rain.
Oh, God. But, okay, the gravitational pull of Sexy Sax Guy, I gotta come back one more time.
We gotta go back to Sexy Sax Guy. Because really, Sexy Sax Guy is and Corey Haim's clothing are the only two truly terrible things about this movie. Because everything else in this film... fucking delivers.
Agreed. But
so Sexy Sax Guy.
Well, Sexy Sax Guy, specifically something you said about the concert that he's putting on with the trash barrels. Santa Carla appears to be a town whose entire economy is beholden to a beachfront hobo carnival. Like, it's like Coney Island all day long.
Everything is lit by trash fires.
And everything, I'm telling you.
I think the other half of the economy, though, is helicopter tours, because the number of shots in this movie shot from a helicopter.
Don't take a shot for every helicopter shot, or you will die of alcohol poisoning. But I feel like the mayor of Santa Carla is like Mayor Hobo Carney, and he is the one. He runs a tight ship. He's the one that books all the talent, all the oily jazz musicians that the kids love, and he keeps those trash barrels lit, Cargill.
He does.
It's not an easy job, but somebody's got to do it, and that is why we have Mayor Hobo Carney.
And, you know, make fun of Mayor Hobo Carney all you want, but that Chamber of Commerce has helped facilitate probably one of the coolest video stores of the 80s.
That is very true.
I mean, that video store is pretty... You kind of want to jump in a time machine and go back. Like, they've got a Kiss of the Spider-Woman standee in the background.
Of Kiss and some kind of I couldn't get a clear shot of it, but it's definitely a Belushi film, because it just says in giant letters of cardboard Belushi across the side of it. So it is 87. Oh. So it's
the other Belushi.
No.
That might be a standee for K-9 or
Kiss of the Spider-Woman,
Kiss
huh,
of
guys?
The Spider-Woman. Yeah, no, but it's a cool-looking store filled with neon, and it's one of those that had the counter in the middle of it, so it's surrounded by VHS rather than towards the front of the store, because it was before they realized that, oh shit, people are just gonna grab like 10 of these and run out the door.
I feel like,
because they do.
I would get caught masturbating in that store, not to any porno selection, but just looking at that store and how glorious it is, and just being
it's a pretty glorious fucking video store.
Mass. So the plot of this movie that we have been kind of dancing around. We have a family, the matriarch played by Diane Wiest, who we have talked about before on this show, and her two sons, Michael and Sam, played by Jason Patrick and Corey Haim, respectively. She has just gotten a divorce, and they are moving in with her father, who lives in the California town of Santa Carla. I always want to say Santa Clara, because that's a real place. Funny enough, they filmed this in... Santa Cruz, which means Holy Cross, which is ironic because it's a vampire movie. Carla is not a real place.
Yeah, and so when they come here, I've got to stress this, because there's only one line of dialogue in this movie that absolutely does not age, like that did not age well, like not even like, oh, that's so very 80s. It's like, that's inappropriate. when mom shows up to her dad's place, grandpa, who is, by the way, the coolest motherfucker in this movie.
So cool.
And he is the obvious hero of the movie, not the unsung hero. We'll get to that.
Yes, sir.
But he turns and says, you know, you're the only woman I've ever known.
Whose situation was not improved by getting a divorce.
Yeah. And it's like... Ooh.
Yeah, we don't know anything about this relationship or why it ended.
And then she starts getting defensive of it. Yeah, I didn't want a protracted court battle. And you realize that what he's saying is she's broke because she didn't take him for alimony, because that's what women did. And it's a particularly sexist line for a movie that is otherwise not misogynistic in any way. Like,
Mr. Cargill, thank you so much for coming to this meeting here at the studio. We are going to remake The Lost Boys, and we just want to put up on the whiteboard the things that you think we should exclude from the updated version. So we've got the horribly sexist line about taking a man for all he's worth in the divorce. And I see that you've also underlined something about TV guides.
Yeah. No, there's a whole TV guide series of references that won't play.
I just feel kids today aren't even going to know what a TV guide is. Yeah. That's my impression of you, apparently, in this boardroom scene.
But you know what? Over in what we need, sexy sax guy.
Just pull
if
everything.
They remake this movie and don't have sexy sax guy, they have failed.
He is still working. He is still a working musician. You can hire sexy sax guy to play your bar mitzvah tonight. That he is available.
That would be kind
He's of on God. Facebook. He is a real person. You can hire him. So they move to Santa Carla, and this town is like Mad Max goes to the fair. Like, it's such a weird, like, punk paradise.
Well, it's a punk paradise, but at the same time, it is, like, so many of these people are clearly homeless.
True.
Like, it's like, you made a joke that it was, you know, they hired all the employees from the local Freebirds.
Which is, I wasn't going to say on the air just because, like, everyone who lives in Austin will know what I'm talking about. Everyone
yeah, Texans, outside of Austin, Texans will know, you know.
Everyone outside of Austin is like, they hired the members of a tribute band for Lynyrd Skynyrd. No, the local burrito chain that is so delicious and not a sponsor of this show, so I will shut up about them. But their employees tend to be the creme de la creme of Austin weird. And that's great. I have nothing against it. But when you see a movie like this and you see all the extras with their mohawks and their face tattoos and their big earrings, it's like, oh, yeah, I feel like I ordered a burrito bowl from that guy.
Yeah. And by the way, if anyone from Freebirds is listening, we would love you to be a sponsor of the show. And we'll gladly advertise for just two burritos a week.
I was gonna, yeah.
For just two burritos a week, you can have us pick because damn, those are good burritos.
We are literally shilling that we'll work for food. We can't really talk about the homeless of Santa Carla anymore.
You know what? We brought up Freebirds and we don't ever talk about how amazing fucking Freebirds is. We talk about gyms an awful lot, but dear God, Freebirds burrito as big as your head is pretty goddamn awesome.
I just want to underline one more time, not a sponsor of the show,
not
although
a sponsor.
It really sounds yet. Like they are now.
Yet.
Tango.
Cash.
Burrito. So, yes.
Stargrove. All right. Yeah, Santa Clara. Yeah, it is. And this is one of the things that I'm curious about, the aesthetic. Because, again, remember, we've talked about this many times, but this is still in the era where crime is getting worse in American society. The murder rate goes up every year for another 5 years after this. It's not till 1992 that we see the first decline in the murder rate in this country.
I like to refer to this as Marion Cobretti's America.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is. It is very much things are getting worse. People believe that society is disintegrating, and that is reflective in film. And in the summer of 87, I feel like this is the film that most has that dystopian backdrop. Like, it's not a dystopian movie, but Schumacher is very much obsessed with the dystopian aesthetic. Like, even the vampires, who are these powerful motherfuckers, are living in this hotel that was sunk in an earthquake in 1906. And that they, you know, hang upside down in a cave and then spend their night in a trash fire lit hovel. Like, what does that gotta fuck? What is Santa Carla gotta smell like? Like, there's always trash to burn. Like, where's all that trash coming from?
I promise you, if I am elected, I will bring a Febreze factory to this town. Yay, Mayor Hobo Carney!
A half trash filled can in every house.
Four more cans.
It is, but so, but yeah, I mean, everything about them is dystopian, and where they go, of course, is a carnival, which is, I feel, is more Pinocchio than Peter Pan, and yet at the same time, it does kind of have that whole Never Neverland feel, and that all those aspects are brought up. You'll never grow up. You'll never grow old. You'll never die, and yet, unlike the Lost Boys of Peter Pan, these guys are unreasonably violent.
I want to talk about the violence in this movie. First, let's just get to the end of the plot synopsis, which is just, turns out that this town is overrun by vampires, particularly this one clan of vampires led by Kiefer Sutherland, who in this movie...
Kind of led by Kiefer Sutherland.
He's rocking that perfect head of hockey hair in this movie. He is so goddamn cool that he's practically a corpse. Oh, wait, no, he's a vampire. He is a fucking corpse. He's like if James Dean suddenly joined Sisters of Mercy, that would be the basic... That's basically Kiefer Sutherland in this movie. There's even an honest-to-goodness Rebel Without a Cause reference in the film when he's like riding on the motorcycle and playing chicken with Jason Patrick. So I don't think that's accidental, but at all. It is a little uncomfortable how many times and how he delivers the name Michael in this movie.
Michael.
It's like, oh my God, this is so fucking creepy. So creepy. But, you know, Kiefer Sutherland's amazing in this movie. And you said kind of the head of this vampire clan. The real head of the vampire clan, as we find out, and I'm hoping if you're listening to this that you've already seen the movie, is Edward Herrmann. How great is Edward Herrmann in this fucking movie?
Edward Herrmann not only is great, Edward Herrmann is the antithesis of Corey Haim. I want you to think about this for a second. He is the antithesis of Corey Haim in which he is also dressed very 80s, but that is the cool 80s and what the 80s actually looked like. Like right. He, like Bernard Herrmann in cutting edge 80s gear, looking pimp as fuck, picking up Diane Weist. Like yeah. That is, and of course he's a fucking vampire.
And I actually think that the misdirect with him is handled quite well, because the movie is called The Lost Boys, so you think about all the characters, all the vampires, and sort of their Neverland analogs. There were no adults palling around with Peter Pan. If you're going to sell the audience on the concept of The Lost Boys and conjure that image in their head, they're not thinking about an adult protector of the Lost Boys. But really, Edward Herrmann is kind of their Windy. You know, he's the one that ends up looking after them. And he is the head vampire, but because you don't think they need that, they can be so bold as to have a plot device in the movie where Corey Haim and the Frog Brothers think that it is Edward Herrmann and try to prove that it is and then fail to do that. And then that's a double red herring. And it's just like, it's actually handled. The only part that really unforgivably gives it away is when Edward Herrmann shows up for dinner and asks Michael very clumsily to be invited in.
Yeah.
Like, that's the part where you're like, okay, well, clearly you're a fucking vampire, because who does that?
Well, yeah, but that's the thing, is that they do that so that the suspicion that has already been raised is, you know, confirmed. And then, he's got no problem with garlic. He's got no problem with holy water. Like, none of this stuff is affecting him at all. He's got a reflection. And then that's where the movie's one truly ingenious concept is brought up at the end of the movie, where they go and repurpose the mythology to where, you know, a vampire can't be invited in. Sure, they can. They can come in if they haven't been invited. But if you invite them in, you are powerless against them. And so being invited into that house, none of the usual tricks against vampires will affect them inside of that house. And I think that's interesting. It's a really interesting way to deal with that, in a way that no other, vampire story I'm familiar with does.
Yeah. No, that's true.
So that's a really cool mythological concept they play around with. And of course there's one other vampire that you'll recognize, Alex Winter, who gets like three lines in this movie.
Kind of a bogus journey for him. That
two of them might. Well, this is a year before he broke. So this is just him getting a gig, you know, as, you know, vampire number three, essentially.
As Per Mullet, the vampire.
Yeah. But you know what? He's intimidating as fuck in it.
He is. I mean, they do a really good job of making all of these vampires intimidating, which brings me back to what you were talking about. Brings me back to shirtless, sexy sax guy. No, brings me back to what you were saying before about the violence in this movie. I remember this movie actually being more violent. I mean, we sat down to watch it today, and I remember in my head this movie being like really grisly. And it gets there. And it gets to a point where it is grisly, but it's at like the hour mark. All of the kills prior to the hour mark are largely off screen.
Yeah.
And that was surprising for me, because that's not what I remember. And I think it's because I might be conflating elements from Near Dark and Lost Boys together.
I believe you are. I mean, that's the thing, is Schumacher's never been a grisly filmmaker. Schumacher is somebody who is very much into cinema. And cutting edge cinema, and sometimes that works and sometimes that really fucking doesn't.
Yeah. Would you say Werner Herzog's a grisly filmmaker? Hey, what are all these lead balloons doing on the floor? No. Somebody could trip on those.
That's your dad jokes kicking in. Dad.
Coffee.
Yeah. So, no, but that's, I mean, that's the thing with Schumacher, though, is, and I want to talk about that for a moment. You know, like sometimes he was really cutting edge. Like, you know, we talk about here where he's doing this. DC Cab is a time where he's trying to be cutting edge and it just doesn't work. Then you've got him, you know, shortly after this doing a future junk food, offering. We're going to do Falling Down at some point.
I want to do Falling Down. I also want to talk about Blood Creek, which I think is a very underrated horror film that he directed. I think I want to talk about Tigerland at some point.
Well, Tigerland is like right in that super slick indie boom where he was so fed up with his reputation and what he had become after the Batman movies that he just took $1 million of his own money and said, I'm going to make a story that I care about and that nobody else does and that I don't have to worry about making money on it, and found this young actor that nobody had heard of named Colin Farrell and turned Colin Farrell into a star. Who would then go on to be in a vampire, playing a vampire of his own in Fright Night, which we covered last year.
And not only that, I mean, Flatliners, like there's a number of Joel Schumacher movies that we should cover on this show, which is hard for me to kind of reconcile because I'm in choppy legal waters over the sheer amount of dog shit that I mailed to his house set on fire because of the Batman movies. But when you really, when you take that out of the equation, when you take Forever and you take Batman and Robin out of his oeuvre, I just said oeuvre about the guy who made Batman and Robin, so clearly I have reconciled it a little bit.
Well, I mean, come on, I would argue that half of his filmography is good to great.
What is his best movie? Like,
Tigerland.
You think
Tigerland's his best movie? Okay. I would say Falling Down is probably easily an arguable second. I think this is his most fun movie, the one that really delivers the most.
So what's your favorite Schumacher, if we're getting away from the category of best? Because this is my favorite Schumacher.
You know what? It's Falling Down. Falling Down is just such a great, dark, entertaining movie. And it also gave me one of my favorite, my favorite work stories of all time.
You can't set it up and not, you know, reap those.
I'm working.
Seeds,
so. Okay. True story. I'm working. It's Christmas Eve. Co-worker has bailed and gone home early and left me to the place. It is 10 minutes to midnight. I finally get to close down and go home.
And naked serial killer walks in and Charles Bronson blows him away?
No, okay. No. But my assistant manager had asked our manager, hey, dude, if things get slow, can I go home and spend Christmas Eve with my wife and leave Cargill to run the place? And the manager's like, yeah, if it really slows down, then yeah, you can definitely cut yourself and go home. And 8:30 hit. We had a very brief 10-minute lull, and he just took off without telling me.
Uh-oh.
And so then we get slammed, and I'm having one of the worst nights of my fucking life in about 10:30, I'm like, you know what? I finally find out where he is. He's not going to come back in because, dude, I'm already at home. I'm already having some wine with my wife. You can handle this. I'm fucking bitter. So I'm like, fuck Blockbuster. Fuck the rules. I'm putting on a rated R fucking movie. I'm putting on Falling Down. So I put on Falling fucking Down. And so I've got that going on in the background while I'm running things. At about 10 minutes to midnight, it's still on, and there is a group of teenagers, fucking college kids, come up, and they're bringing up their movies, and one of the girls keeps pressing the button on one of those singing, dancing Christmas toys that Blockbuster required you to have.
Special circle of hell reserved just for you.
Yeah, and of course, you have to have a couple up on the counter to, you know, maybe sell through, and this girl keeps pressing it. Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle all the way. Like, at over and over again. And so right before she presses it again, I go, oh, hey, have you ever seen this movie? And her and her friends all look up and go, no, what's this? I'm like, oh, this is Falling Down. dude, this is a great movie. And they're like, well, what is it about? I'm like, it's about a guy who's having the worst, you know, the worst day of his life. Things are just going wrong in his life, and he snaps and he takes a baseball bat and a machine gun, and he just goes to fuck with everybody who just is ruining his goddamn day. So stop touching the goddamn doll. The girl jumps back 10 feet and her friends fall over laughing. And she's humiliated, but at the same time, her friends are just like doubled over. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm having the worst night of my life. And she laughs it off. But yeah, so that was.
So we're going to tell that story again on the Falling Down episode. And easiest junk food pairing ever, give me a McDonald's breakfast sandwich. I don't care what time we record
that episode. I don't
care
what time it is. A goddamn sandwich at 10:35 in the morning. But yeah, so that Falling Down, though, is really great. And, you know, me and my wife just recently rewatched Flatliners together. We had a night where we stayed up till.
It's been on TV. In fact, I don't have cable, but I have an over-the-air HD antenna. And there's a channel that's just called Movies. And they've been showing it like every other day.
It holds up. It's really fucking good. So Schumacher.
Back to shirtless sexy
Schumacher,
sex guy.
Yeah, no, Schumacher has done enough good to great stuff that I think he gets falsely maligned because of the Batman movies. And I think we've seen enough Batman movies that haven't been good that blaming Schumacher for fucking up Batman. Did he make the worst Batman movies? Yeah, pretty much. But still, there's some others that, you know, you know what they did? He may have put nipples in the bat suit, but he didn't have, why'd you say that name?
Yeah, he's not.
Why'd you say that name?
He's not responsible for Martha Gate. I would rather watch Batman and Robin than watch that movie again, because at least Batman and Robin is a movie.
Yeah.
What were we talking about? Oh, yeah.
Schumacher.
Stargrove. So The Lost Boys, one of the things that I really love about this movie is the fact that the Frog Brothers are, like you were saying before, are set up to be the Van Helsing. By the way, Edgar and Alan Frog, because yes. Subtlety.
Because subtlety.
Really puts the B in subtlety.
You know what? This movie doesn't hit you over the head with a lot of things, so I'll allow Edgar and Alan. Like, that's acceptable.
Allow it.
I'll allow it.
How much, okay, the introductory scene, as we were talking about with the Frog Brothers, how much do you think, like, middle-aged comic book nerds watch that scene and just drool? Because they are walking past some mint condition classic issues.
Oh, yeah. No, this is the thing about where this point is in the 80s. Comics were still huge, but the dealer boom hadn't happened yet. So you could walk into a comic book store. I had a comic book store like this in Tucson, Arizona, where you would walk in and they had giant sized X-Men number one for $120 on the wall.
Yeah.
Like it was something you could get that was relatively affordable. There were a couple times where I kicked around saving up a bunch of my paper route money
allowance
and buying a couple of those older comics. And I was like, you know what? I kind of want more comics rather than special comics. And, you know, the older me is like, you fool. That was an investment that you really could have made money on. And then the other part of me is like, yeah, but I ended up spending it on comics, which was an investment in the person I would become. So fuck yeah. But yeah, that is what it was like. Like, you would find old comics just kind of on the shelf like that, readily accessible. Like, him going in and saying, I'm looking for Batman 14, was something that wasn't unreasonable. Like, yeah, you weren't going to find, a small store was never going to have Detective Comics number 27 or Action Comics number one, but something like Batman 14 was something that could have happened.
You would have to save up for it, but not for your entire life.
Yeah. Yeah. It is really great. The thing about the Frog Brothers, in fact, it's so interesting. Corey Feldman's performance is probably the weirdest thing about this movie.
The affectation. What is he doing?
He's doing a Vietnam War vet.
Okay.
Like, he's a 14-year-old kid playing a grizzled Vietnam War vet.
That actually makes sense, because one of the things I was looking at in my research was that apparently Joel Schumacher said to Corey Feldman, I want this character to be a version of the current action stars. So he made him watch a lot of movies by Chuck Norris and Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, and he's doing this weird, he's doing this very weird voice where he is clearly doing his version of Arnold and Sly.
He's trying to hit the basement of his own register at 14.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just not totally working, but it also is really funny and really works because of that. I think, I don't know if it's intentional or accidental, but either way it works because this guy is so full of shit. He doesn't know anything about vampires whatsoever. Everything he knows, he's learned from comic books. And there's even a line later where it's revealed, like, you know, it's like, you didn't know that, did you? Yeah, of course I did. Cause he literally doesn't know anything. So he is like, it's so, this movie is, you know, and here's what I think Schumacher was really getting at with this film is I really feel like what's going on in the background of this film is this film's about toxic masculinity.
Oh, you
know,
for sure.
You've got these, you know, the toxic masculinity of the vampires. The only two vampires who deserve to be saved are Letty and Star, who's a child, a young boy, and then a woman, a girl.
A girl played by Jamie Gertz.
Heartbreaker of the late 80s, baby.
I believe the most respectful woke way to put this is, God damn, Jamie Gertz.
Oh, she was, yeah, no, she was, yeah, she was the heartbreaker of that era.
She and Jason Patrick officially make The Lost Boys the Solar Babies reunion that no one asked for.
That's right. I mean, that's the, you cracked me up. You, during the love scene, you just leaned over and it's like, that's how you make a solar baby. And it's like,
your reaction
was
never
going to be able to watch that love scene again.
But without, your reaction was spot on. You're like, that's a great joke that'll never play.
Like 12 of you out there just got that, and congratulations, you're in our club.
You have escaped the clutches of the Protectorate. Good job.
Also, you accidentally may have spawned a month where we just talk about rollerblading movies. Because we had to do that and then follow it up with the FP, which people have asked us to cover, which you can't really cover unless you know the movies that influenced the FP, because the FP is really kind of a remake of four movies.
Welcome to the weirdest, the weirdest rabbit hole you'll ever tumble down while listening to Junk Food Cinema.
Yeah, but the Solar Babies is one of the movies that the FP is definitely making fun of. But anyhow, yeah. So it is. So, but so you've got the toxic masculinity of that, and then you have this faux toxic masculinity of the Frog Brothers, who are pretending to be these big swinging dick guys, and they are fuck all. Trivia question, folks, all you out there.
I'm sorry,
land,
I believe what you meant to say was pop quiz hot shot.
Pop quiz hot shot. Well, that's Speed instead of Speed 2 with Jason Patrick.
Fuck.
So how many vampires are the Frog Brothers personally responsible for killing?
One.
Yes. Well, I was...
Oh, I'm sorry. But you just said they can't answer you. Yes. You said they can't answer you, so I was trying to fill in the silence.
No, I was going to see if you could go back and put a pause in there, like a pregnant pause, so that people could think about it.
With a little bit of old
because
school game show
music. Actually only kill one vampire.
While he's sleeping.
While he's asleep.
They might as well have killed Bill Pullman with a stake and while he was thinking, sleeping.
And you might be out there thinking, you know, who is this? This isn't my beautiful house. This isn't my beautiful wife. And didn't the Frog Brothers push the Winger lead singer into the bathtub? No. Nanook, the secret hero of this fucking film.
Yes. The Frog Brothers present themselves as Van Helsing. Turns out they're more like Peter Vincent from Fright Night. Yeah. They are just bumbling.
They kill one guy and get covered in goo and freak the fuck out and take off.
Which, by the way, is a scene within 2 years, another scene of Corey Feldman crawling through a cave going, come on, come on, we gotta get out of here. So that's always fun.
So,
but who's the other unlikely hero of this movie? We got the dog is one of the great unlikely heroes. And then, of course, the other unlikely hero turns out to be
Grandpa.
Yes.
Everybody remembers Grandpa, but everyone kind of forgets that Nanook actually does more saving of lives in this movie than almost anyone else,
which is why oh my God, when they go out and they rescue the dog because he's outside when the vampires are showing up, that's not a save the cat moment. One, because it's a dog, but two, because it's like, no, you're going to fucking need him. That's not just a moment to endear you to these characters. That is a moment of survival utilization. Like, they need that dog to save their asses.
And Nanook is pretty great. And they use Nanook in quite a bit in this movie as Robert Rodriguez's cut to the dog. Like, Robert Rodriguez, here's an editing thing. Robert Rodriguez has a term that he referred to as cutting to the dog, which is in order to break up the staccato of back and forth, back and forth, back and forth between two characters, you have like a dog so that you can break it up to cut to the dog. And cutting to the dog can also be a character who has no lines in the scene where you just cut to them and their reaction.
We take you live to this dog.
And they actually used Nanook that way. And I was noticing that it's like, oh, hey, they're doing the cut to the dog. It's like, hey, let's break this up. What's Nanook up to? He's looking up at everyone, wondering what they're talking about, preparing to be a hero later in the movie. But yeah, Nanook scores a kill in the final scene and the Frog Brothers do not. The Frog Brothers kill no one in the final sequence and then have the audacity to ask, how much should we charge for this?
Yeah, suddenly they're Ghostbusters. I'm like, fuck off, Frog Brothers. You're not the Ghostbusters.
The one thing they were right about, though, that was really interesting, they have one point that they are absolutely 100% right on, and that's that no vampire dies the same way.
Correct.
And it's interesting how they do that in this movie.
It's an Edgar Wright moment.
It works.
It's an Edgar Wright moment where, I know this is before Edgar Wright, but just humor me. It's an Edgar Wright moment where you set up exactly what's going to happen over the next few minutes without the audience knowing that's what you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
It's Ed's speech to Sean when he's like, here's what we're going to do tomorrow. And you realize that every single thing.
Bloody Mary.
Yeah,
you know.
Bite at the king's head, stagger back here for shots. Like, he's describing the sequence of events without you knowing that's what's going on. Yeah. But I want to talk for a little bit about the original draft of the script. The final draft was written by a guy named Jeffrey Boehm, who himself had a hell of a 1987. On top of being the one who is basically responsible for this movie, because the original draft was very much borrowed heavily from Peter Pan. Like, Michael, played by Jason Patrick, his brother was not Sam, but John, and their mother's name was not Lucy, but Wendy. Like, they were really going, like hitting you over the head with the Neverland stuff. And in fact, David was called Peter in the original. Like, it was basically just Peter Pan as a vampire movie. So he basically took that and created what we now know is The Lost Boys. So he did that. He also worked on the scripts for Lethal Weapon, Inner Space, and then later wrote the TV version of Witches of Eastwick. So he would, and then he would go on to write the Lethal Weapon sequels, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and of course, junk food favorite, The Phantom. Which means he wrote two lines that are troubling. One is, of course, no one refuses the Phantom. The other is in this movie where he says, don't struggle. It's not fun if you struggle. So I have some questions for Mr. Boehm, but he was having a hell of a 1987. So I cannot believe we got almost all the way to the end of this episode without me mentioning one of my absolute favorite things about this movie, and that is, of course, the soundtrack, including the little ditty.
The stripper anthem, the song that launched a million boners across the nation.
So many lap dances. I would get to the song Cry Little Sister.
Oh my God. You could not walk into a strip club in the 90s without having the gothy girl slow strip to this song. Like, it was.
And you know what? Thou shalt not turn down that lap dance. Thou shalt not turn down the radio when this song comes on, because this is the best song about incest since the Reigns of Castamere. It is so weird in its content, because first you have little kids in a choir, and then you have someone like talking about, like, come to your brother and you're my sister, and it's weirdly sexual. But the song itself and the synth elements and the vocals, it is one of my favorite 80s movie songs of all time.
And it's interesting because this entire soundtrack is great, save Sexy Sax Guy.
Wait, what are you trying to say? Sexy Sax Guy does not have a good single, because I still believe that he is awesome.
I still
believe that song is fantastic.
You can. However, It does.
The mayor's going to hear about this.
There's a that's fine. There's Mayor a Hobo lot Kong. Of there's a lot of great music in this, but interestingly enough, there's a cover of People Are Strange
by Echo and the Bunnymen.
Yeah, by Echo and the Bunnymen, and there is a very large poster of Jim Morrison down in the Batcave. So
yeah, their lair, by the way, it looked like if they ever did a fourth live action Ninja Turtles movie, that's where they would be living.
Yeah. And so I can't help but it's really interesting because this was made in 87 and we wouldn't get, I want to say two more years. It wouldn't be till I think 89
till
90, maybe even
Oliver 91. Stone's The Doors.
Yeah. But The Doors would happen.
91.
But The Doors were, you know, they were, it was all over, you know, at this point. Like it was like to fully understand what The Doors were in the 80s and early 90s, it is like Nirvana is now. Like that is exactly what it was. Like it was, you know, except The Doors never had that member that went off and became, you know, huge and had an even bigger, far greater, longer career than his predecessor band. So, you know, the way people look at Kurt Cobain now is very much how it was, you know, this is, I want to say 15 years after Jim Morrison died. So it's there's a lot of reverence for him. The music was ubiquitous at the time, and having that cover by Echo and the Bunnymen, and then showing that image of Morrison and the whole kind of, because there was still that conspiracy theory that he was still alive, and you know, but this idea that he would live, you know, it's thematically tied into you're going to live forever,
living on youth. Beyond death. Okay, I just now got the connection and why so much Jim Morrison in this movie. At first, I thought it was just because they managed to make Jason Patrick's haircut look exactly like Jim Morrison's, but no, you're right. It's the idea that a rock star could live forever after death.
Okay. And that's very much what they are, is they are these guys who are going to live forever. They are these rock stars. And I love that. And this is one of the things I love about Schumacher. When Schumacher is on fire, his thematic content is really on point. And he really digs down deep. And I think that's what fails about Batman. I mean, the Batman movies, I think the biggest problem is he was fetishizing the 66 Batman and thinking, let's take the aesthetic of today and make a 66 Batman. And it's like, no, that's not what we wanted from a comic book movie. You know, less than a decade later, we'd get Nolan's version. And then it would be like, that's what a fucking Batman movie is. And from here on out, that's what everything will be compared to. But he was gunning for that 66 aesthetic, and it just did not work in the 90s.
Yeah.
But here he is thematically on point, and there's all sorts of just subtle stuff throughout. You know, the obsession with comics, the obsession with pop culture, Jim Morrison, the great music, like everything here is driving a really great near dystopian vampire narrative.
Okay, so going back to posters on the wall before...
Oh, my... Oh my, yes. This is the one thing we missed.
In Corey Haim's room, he has Echo and the Bunnymen. Makes sense. He has a poster of Molly Ringwald, of course. Girl Next Door. Makes total sense. He also has a poster of a near shirtless Rob Lowe.
Half shirt Rob Lowe.
Half shirt Rob Lowe. And
he's got it on his closet.
And it's revealed right before his mom starts talking about she left his dad because of the closet monster. And
he didn't believe in the closet monster. Now I get where your line of thinking is, but the way that line is delivered, you know why I left your father, right? Because he didn't believe in the closet monster. I think that was the very subtle thing of saying the reason that they got divorced and the reason why things went the way it did is because he didn't know that dad didn't know he was gay. And that,
so maybe it's dad's Rob Lowe poster.
No, the Rob Lowe poster on the closet. I'm not certain if that is, well, I mean, Schumacher, who is publicly out. That might be his subtle thing of like, Corey Haim is gay. Like Corey Haim doesn't have any, love interest in the movie. So maybe in his mind, in the headcanon, this is a gay character who's yet to embrace who he truly is.
And that's where I thought they were going with the closet monster. And then later you have a scene where he's singing a song and he's singing in falsetto, "I ain't got a man." And
yeah.
You know, like maybe that's what it is. And that's fine if that's what it is.
And that could all be his subtle stuff. Like maybe Schumacher sees this character as himself and himself as a teen, and this is his stuff. Because also there is some, again, there's some 80s, there's some 50s fetishization in this movie. We've talked about this a couple times. This is another movie that does it. They've got a 57 Chevy in there, which in 1987 was the coolest fucking car in the world you could have. And it was the convertible, 57 Chevy convertible with the license plate 57 flip.
Yeah. And speaking of homoeroticism, I just have to ask one more question. How much does the Covenant wish it was the Lost Boys?
Oh, I think it really, really wanted to be.
The Lost Boys.
Again, take a drink. We have not talked about this yet, but we both have a mad, sick love of the Covenant. For all the right reasons.
This is the movie that the Covenant dreams about before it wakes up awkwardly moist. Like, yeah. There is so much. You watch the Covenant, you're like, okay, you almost got it. You almost understood what was going on with Lost Boys, but then they even have the same fucking jump off the cliff scene. It's the same fucking scene, guys.
Fuck Harry Potter.
Fuck Harry Potter. No. You should be saying fuck Joel Schumacher, because that's who you're actually ripping off with that scene.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. It wants to be the Lost Boys, and it's just not. But yeah. So I think Haim might be the representation of Schumacher. He might be his avatar in this movie.
It's possible.
And that it's all very subtle stuff.
He has a poster for a movie called...
Reform Schoolgirls.
Reform Schoolgirls. I looked up that movie. Joel Schumacher had nothing to do with that movie. He's not involved in it in any way.
I love it.
You could argue that the Rob Lowe poster is because he directed Less Than Zero, right?
Yes.
Okay. He had nothing to do with Reform School... What was it called?
Reform Schoolgirls.
Reform Schoolgirls. And I looked it up, and the movie is just about girls in this prison, and it's like it has sort of that same kind of gay subtext to it. So it's like you're right. I think there's a lot of little things that could key you into the fact that maybe Sam is gay, but they don't. It's not even addressed because Sam has no love interest in this movie.
Yeah, there's no room for it. It's a very lean movie. What I will say is I do think that line about the father. I think the father's gay. I think that's why there was a divorce. Because otherwise, the closet monster line just seems out of place. Like, Sam isn't young enough to believe in monsters anymore. Right. I mean, maybe that's a harmless joke, but I feel like it's supposed to look like a harmless joke. But it's really, here's the explanation for what happens. And that's also why Mom didn't want to take Dad to the cleaners. Because when she says it's complicated and I don't want a lengthy court battle, it's because she doesn't want to humiliate her husband, you know, because... he didn't know who he was, because she's someone with a huge heart, which is what, and that's what, you know, Bernard Herrmann's character is attracted to.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he falls in love with. He's like, he wants this woman to be a mother. She's got the mothering instinct. She cares about people. He needs someone to complete the family, to help take care of and keep the Lost Boys in check. Mm-hmm. And that, I feel, is the final piece to the puzzle of, like, here's a woman with such a big heart. She's willing to live in poverty rather than humiliate her ex-husband and drag things out so that she can have alimony, because the guy didn't know he was gay.
Yeah. And I want to make something very clear. I want to put a fine point on this. I'm not saying these things from a judgment. Like, if Sam is gay, good for him.
That there's anything wrong with that.
Because there's not. And if Sam is gay, good for him. But what I'm doing is examining this movie from all angles and finding things that are unexpected for a movie like this, for a big studio film in 1987, to even play with that idea, to even hint or you know, subconsciously play with that idea.
It was not out of the realm of possibility. It was just never.
It was really never bold.
Forward in it was never up front in the 80s. In the 90s, you started seeing it a bit more, and in the 90s, then you could start really starting to see it, and then we started to break a lot of the taboos. But in the 80s. There's the subtlety there. Yeah. Like there's people that definitely played around with, I mean, as we'll eventually talk about and has been mentioned on the show, you know, that was the screenwriter's intention entirely with Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Yes.
So this stuff was starting to come out. You're starting to see, like, if you want to talk in terms of Hollywood itself, you're starting to see the emergence of what would be known as the gay mafia, which is a group of gay people in Hollywood who all work together to keep gay members of the community working and not run out on a rail like they used to be. And would then become so powerful that people would fear them. And there used to be a joke that you never mentioned that there was a gay mafia. Like, you just didn't talk about it. Because if you did, then your career could be taken down by some very powerful people. And so I think this is kind of hinting at the emergence of that. And, if I'm right, is fucking awesome.
Yeah. And it's just interesting that on one end of the spectrum, you have the closet monster and this subtle, like, possible flirtation with the idea that a young character is gay. And the other end of that spectrum is opening two Batman movies with codpiece shots. So, I mean, it really runs the full
and
gamut.
And nipples on the bat suit.
And nipples on the bat suits. I mean, it really runs the full gamut throughout his career. And just one other thing before we close out here, I want to talk about, I think that there are more monsters in Santa Carla than just vampires. And it didn't hit me until this viewing. But this movie, all throughout, we watch the vampires feed on a fat security guard,
yep,
a pair of young lovers who are conservatively in their mid-40s, and a bunch of burnouts partying on the beach. Those are all adults. However, throughout the movie, we see all of these missing posters and all these milk cartons for children. There's one child who has clearly been snatched up by the Klan, and that's Laddie. But they're just keeping him around. They didn't murder him. But if the posters are to be believed, several children are missing. But all of the victims we see them take are adults. So my question is, did they used to steal kids and they stopped? Or did they never steal kids and there's something else killing the children of Santa Carla?
Honestly, I think it's just more vampires. I mean,
this isn't the only clan.
Oh, no, not at all. Because, I mean, keep in mind this movie has one of, if not the greatest final line of a movie ever. Like, this is literally one of those greatest final lines ever. And the reaction shot and the way Schumacher, we get the line and then we cut to our protagonists, and then the way the light dims,
he
as
turns
the door
off the lights
closed
and goes home. It's like a Cheers moment. You got that great final line, and yeah, then Schumacher just turns off the damn lights and goes home.
There's one thing I could never stomach about Santa Clara: all the damn vampires. So I think these kids prey on adults because, of course, this is a Peter Pan narrative, and the kids that they get involved with are to join them. I mean, that's the thing, is you have Letty, you have Star, you have Jason Patrick. Like, they intend to kill Jason Patrick, and Star can't do it. So they're like, well, fuck it, he's one of us then. So we've got that. But I think there's other vampire clans running around. And I'm not even sure, like, the security guard is the one that always gives me tingles, because the way the security guard grabs David, Kiefer Sutherland, and then says, how many times do I have to tell you, you're not allowed here, makes me think there's something else going on with him. Like, he gets killed later, but he has no way to defend himself. So you're like, oh, he's a victim. He was just a brash, you know, just a brash security guard. But I've always kind of felt like, he's something else.
Like, it's a what do you mean you people kind of line?
Yeah. Like, well, it's a, yeah, like that he is something else. Like, yeah. I don't know. So your theory is not necessarily wrong. I just tend to believe that there's more vampires there, that's what's going on, and that there just are too many, but this is this clan.
Interesting.
So, yeah. But that's what I've always felt.
One thing about living in Santa Carla I never could stomach: all the damn vampires.
And that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing. And this week, I'm going with Chinese food.
Chinese. Good choice.
Yeah. No, that's there's no other way to go. You got to go with rice and noodles.
Sometimes a noodle's just a noodle. But sitting down for this beloved comfort food with a punk rock vampire clan may have you biting off more than you would ever want to chew. Whether it's maggots in the rice or worms for noodles, Lost Boys somehow found a way to make the greatest takeout chow of all time less palatable than a spoonful of MSG. How can a billion Chinese people not be offended by this scene?
How are those maggots? Maggots, Michael. You're eating maggots. How do they taste?
it's disgusting. Like, and I can't, like, but I will forever remember it. Yeah, because it's just great. Mind games. He's just fucking with him.
No, it is one of the centerpiece scenes of this movie that works so well. So well. But it's also one of those things that reminds me, like, they're young vampires and they're not very powerful yet. And they're just playing around with their mind powers. And I feel like David's like, ha, watch what I could do. And it's like, really? You could convince a guy that he's eating maggots and worms? And like, that's the extent of your mind powers?
That's like bragging about mastering Oculus Reparo on the train ride over to Hogwarts. Yeah, I'm talking to you, Hermione. I'm throwing shade.
Just throw some shade.
Throwing shade.
Yeah. But yeah, it's like, ha, 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 I'm so powerful. It's like, dude, that's the best you could, like, that's your mind games? Fuck, dude. Like, that, your Jedi mind tricks suck, Kiefer.
I wonder if it's Sexy Sax guy that's killing all the kids in Could Santa be. Carla.
He like, come on, in this movie, of course, all the vampires look like rockers, like rock stars of some kind. It's Sexy. I think we solved it. It's Sexy Sax guy is eating all the kids.
I still believe we solved it. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Junk Food Cinema. I'm so excited we got to talk about The Lost Boys. Thank you so much for joining us on this trip through the sands of Santa Carla. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on the Twitters at Massawyrm, MassaWyrm, and on Instagram at Massawyrm.
Oh, that's new. That's new for you.
I've been doing a lot of traveling lately, and certain friends and some followers have been like, you need to post more pictures. And several of my friends are like, why don't you have an Instagram? And I'm like,
because Instagram can only handle so many pictures of Warhammer figurines.
Exactly. And so, but you know, I was like, you know, I'm going to Hawaii and we're doing this event and we've got several cons coming up and I'm like, and I've got a book tour coming up and I'm like, you know what? Sure, and Instagram. So yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massaworm.
Hey, speaking of cons, this weekend, Armadillo Con here in Austin, Texas. We will be at the Omni South Park Ballroom D at 8:00 on Saturday night. If you can't make it out for the show, I'm sure we will be at some nearby bar directly thereafter, kind of decompressing from the show. We'd love to hear from you. We'll also be at the Alamo Drafthouse in Omaha on August 12th for that marathon, drafthouse.com/Omaha.
And I will be at Dragon Con this year as a guest. So if you're in Atlanta and going to Dragon Con, check it out. I'll be there, of course. And we are 1 month away. We are just 1 month out from the release of Sea of Rust, my next novel. And it would do me, it would make me feel so good if you pre-ordered it or went and picked it up at wherever you buy books.
If you still buy them in places that are stores or if you buy them from the interwebs, buy the book however you will. You can find me on Twitter at Briguy Salisbury. And of course, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema is how you can support us directly to make sure we get to keep being on the air and throwing out theories about serial killers who are oiled up saxophone musicians and throwing shade on Hermione Granger. This is the kind of thing that we do. So until next week, sleep all day, party all night, never grow old, never die. It's fun to be a junkie on.